Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. I've got a great guest today, Jake Shimabukuro. He's a guy, a ukulele virtuoso. I'm sure you know him. I followed his career since he started becoming popular and a super talented guy. Lovely guy, personifies the Hawaiian aloha spirit on top of that. Class act, real gentleman. So I want to thank our mutual friend, John Bleicher, for connecting us. John, thanks as always. You're really kind to me. Real quick, let me give you a Cliff Note version of Jake's background. Ukulele virtuoso, he's known worldwide this is my writing, from my perspective, for the joy he shares about ukulele, really, as well as his excellent playing. He plays Hawaiian music as well as jazz, blues, rock, funk, bluegrass, classical, and other genres on the ukulele. He makes ukulele playing fun. I mean, you could tell he's having a great time. He even covered Ozzy Osbourne's Mama, I'm Coming Home on one of his records, which I thought was really cool. He's also written full scores to two Japanese movies. After starting his solo career in 2002, he shot to fame in 2006, and I guess what was one of the earliest videos to go viral on YouTube, which is a video of him playing his rendition of the great Beatles song, While My Guitar Gently Weeps. And if you haven't heard him do that version, any of the many recordings of Jake doing that version of song played, it's just a beautiful song. He does a great job with it. He started playing ukulele at age 4, taking lessons from his mother, who is a very accomplished player. To date, I hope I got these numbers right, Jake's released 16 solo albums and 10 more albums released only in Japan, and he's won a combined several dozen Hano Hano Awards, which are like Hawaiian Grammys, as well as Hawaii Music Awards. Dude, it's so nice to have you here today. And it's 6 a.m. in Hawaii. This guy is like just so cool. Thank you so much for everything, man.
No, Craig, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for having me on, man. It's an honor to be here. And yeah, just looking forward to just talking music with you. So thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it. And thanks for that intro as well.
Thank you, man.
Very kind of you.
So in general, what was the music scene like in Hawaii when you were growing up, and how has that changed over the years?
Oh, it was always inspiring. I mean, growing up here in Hawaii, there were just so many wonderful ukulele players, you know, that inspired me and that I grew up listening to. One of my biggest inspirations for playing the instrument was an ukulele player named Ota-san, or Herb Ota Sr. And he just, you know, he played all different styles of music, just a master improviser, and recorded, over 70 records, you know, and just kind of introduced the ukulele to so many people all over the world. And so he was my biggest inspiration. And, but, you know, of course, growing up here, there was like, of course, Israel Kamaka Viva Ole. There was, Peter Moon, Eddie Kamai, Troy Fernandez, Kelly Boy De Lima, Gordon Mark. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. So, yeah, it was very, I'm so grateful, you know, that I was born and raised in Hawaii, because the ukulele was my passion. But, you know, probably it wouldn't have been had I not have been born and raised here. So.
Yeah, man, that's a very good, if you were born in like the Bronx, that probably wouldn't have happened. Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Another thing too is my mom played the ukulele. So, you know, when I was 4 years old, she sat me down, taught me a few chords, and I just fell in love with it. So yeah, my mom definitely was, played a big part in why I play today.
How's the music scene now? Like, have a lot of venues, you know, like, is it suffered the same thing all over has suffered with venues closing and things like that, and DJs instead of bands? Or
yeah, things definitely started opening up again, and you know, so it's wonderful to have live music and opportunities, you know, to go hear bands and just, you know, have people come together again, you know, have these because there's just something. I mean, well, you know, I mean, to me, there's nothing like live music, right?
Oh,
that
yeah.
brings a community together. So, yeah, it's just wonderful, you know, to have venues opening up again and just see all my buddies out there playing. And, you know, we're just so grateful and so glad to be back at it.
Right on, man. So wind the clock back a little bit. You were working in a music store as a kid and your band Pure Heart, which you've aged like since I've seen like older pictures, man. I really, we should be talking about your aging formula here because that's what I'm interested in more than almost anything else. But so you're working in a music store and your band Pure Heart, which was you, a guitarist and a percussionist, you release your first record and you win 4 Nahoku Hanohano Awards, which again is like for the listeners, for like the Hawaiian Grammys. You get Contemporary Album of the Year, Most Promising Artist, Album of the Year, and Favorite Entertainment of the Year. And I had a couple of questions about that. Before getting that kind of recognition, had you been thinking about playing music as a full-time career? And if not, getting those awards, did that make you stop and consider it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely not. When I first started playing with my buddies in that was my first, you know, band. We were just kids in high school, you know, mm-hmm. having fun. I mean, this was back in the mid to late 90s, right? So, I met John, and our guitar player and singer, in high school. We were in student government together, you know, and we just loved playing music. So after meetings, we would get together and just jam. And but yeah, we started out just playing at our friends' graduation parties and, you know, little events in town, and played in little coffee shops, and kind of one thing led to another. You know, my ukulele teacher at the time started up a record label. So, you know, he offered to record us.
That was interesting. Yeah. Okay.
We made our first album and we didn't think anything was going to come of it, but you know, the radio stations got a hold of it and they started playing it on the local radio. And we were just like, oh my goodness, you know, we couldn't believe it. So, it was such an unbelievable experience. And I really discovered that I love performing, you know, in front of audiences, and just love sharing that joy of music, you know, with people. And I'm glad you mentioned that about the joy, right, of performing and just what music brings, because the ukulele has brought me so much joy, you know, in my life. And I'm so grateful that I have opportunities to share that joy with people, you know, because as you know, it's infectious, and
yeah.
and the ukulele is such a joyful instrument that is so accessible and I think easy to play. And I joke around and tell people that you know, you don't have to be a musician to play the ukulele.
So at that point, then you said, hey, maybe this could be something I could do full time.
Yeah, I think even at that time too, you know, we still didn't know how long it was going to last, but we were having so much fun. We were all still in college, you know, taking classes. And but yeah, we always knew that we probably should have something to fall back on, you know, right. in case it didn't work out. And, but yeah, cause our singer at the time, our lead singer, you know, he was, ended up graduating college, and, you know, and now he's like a super successful realtor, you know,
so oh, that's cool.
It's like, but he still does music, you know, kind of, as a hobby.
Right.
Side. And during the pandemic, we had a few, kind of virtual reunion concerts.
You know? Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, that must have been really cool. Mm-hmm. Beyond the sheer joy of getting that recognition and winning those awards, which you won another one for Pure Heart's second record, was there anything else you learned or any other kind of messages you felt the universe was sending you from, you know, getting this recognition and kind of blowing up a little bit?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was, gosh, I mean, especially, you know, to be recognized in Hawaii at the Nahoku Hanohano Awards. I mean, that's like, it's like the highest honor, you know, especially growing up here, and you are being nominated and voted on by, you know, all your heroes, the people you grew up listening to, and your mentors and your peers, and so it truly is. I mean, it was just, we were blown away. I mean, I remember that night that we won for our first record. I mean, I couldn't stop crying. You know,
we were
just so blown away. But you know, even back then, we weren't really touring. We're basically just playing in Hawaii.
And, yeah.
We would kind of do some island hopping and, you know, perform in the neighbor islands. But man, we were just loving it. We were having so much fun. And I think there was probably, you know, at some point during that time, I realized that wow, yeah, I would love to be able to do this, you know, for as long as I can. But you know, there's always that idea in the back of your head, you know, that knows that, okay, well, if it doesn't work out, you know, we gotta have something to fall back on.
Yeah, for sure. I watched a number of interviews with you, and I know that you were shy as a younger adult.
Yeah, I was very shy. Yeah.
And you said you preferred playing with other musicians early on. Yet in 2002, you decided, to pursue a solo career. And I was curious, what led to that decision? And how did you, you know, that took a lot of courage from, if you are a shy person, how'd you get out of your comfort zone to play solo?
Yeah, you know, when I was with the band Pure Heart, and then later on, after we had disbanded, I started up another band with our percussionist, and we named the band after his father, who was Augie Colon. Mm-hmm. And Augie Colon was the legendary percussionist in the Martin Denny band, like way back in the day. So we called ourselves Colon after his father, and still in that context, you know, I was still just a sideman, which I loved, you know. I mean, we had a singer, and in the middle of the song, I would kind of step up and do like my little 16 bar ukulele solo, and then step back and just kind of, you know, keep to myself. But when we disbanded as well, that was in the year 2000, I remember thinking, oh, what am I going to do now? Because I don't sing, and I didn't feel comfortable just performing on stage by myself. So at that time I thought, well, maybe I'll try teaching, you know. So I opened up an ukulele school, and I started teaching kids, and I loved working, you know, working with people who were enthusiastic about the ukulele. And I kind of missed that actually, you know, now, because I don't get a lot of opportunities to do that anymore. But I loved it. But then I started getting opportunities, you know, to perform as a soloist.
Like solo gigs in bars and restaurants?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, I think part of it was I still had this desire to still be able to perform, right, mm-hmm. every once in a while. So there were two restaurants on Oahu that would allow me to come in and just kind of play and do whatever I wanted. And it was a restaurant called The Willows and another restaurant called Chai's Island Bistro. And both restaurants have since, you know, closed down. But it was so much fun, you know, because they basically just said, oh, yeah, Jake, come in, do whatever you want. So I would come in, invite friends down, you know, to the restaurant, and I would just kind of work up arrangements and do different things. Because at the time, I didn't really have too many songs that I could play just by myself, right? So I had to work on some solo ukulele arrangements and kind of, you know, get a repertoire, you know, get some songs together, sure. right? And that's kind of what led to the whole, solo performance thing. And at the time, my manager, who was from Japan, knew some people, and through her contacts, was able to get me to Japan and perform at a showcase where they invited a lot of record label executives to come down and hear me play. And so this was back in 2000, maybe end of 2000, early 2001 maybe. And so at the showcase, there was a couple executives from Sony Music came down, and they really saw something in me that they liked and offered me a 7-album contract in Japan. So yeah, and that's what started it all, you know. So actually, I just got back from Japan 2 days ago. We had our first tour there since the pandemic, and it was awesome. I mean, we did 8 shows, you know, 8 cities, and it was just so great to be back. And we were celebrating my 20th anniversary with Sony Music, you know, wow. because it was exactly 20 years ago when I signed with them.
And you're still with Sony?
Still with Sony, yeah.
Wow, that's like a million years in the music business, you know, to be seriously, man, I don't need to tell you that. That's great.
Yeah, and you know, and another cool thing too, when I first signed with Sony, my A&R at Sony, Kazi Ito, he was my A&R for 10 years, which is
unprecedented. Oh my God. Yeah, that is unprecedented.
Especially in Japan, right? There's just so much turnover. But yeah, you know, I'm so grateful because, you know, he was really the guy who helped develop me and, you know, introduced me to all kinds of different music, helped me with my songwriting and arranging skills. And so I learned so much from that opportunity, you know. So this was you know, 2001, released my first record with them in 2002. So that's why this is my 20th year with them since my first album debut. But then a few years after that, I was fortunate enough to have this little video on YouTube that went viral, the one that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And that opened up a whole bunch of other doors for me, you know. So, so grateful, you know, for all that has happened over the years. But I've been loving every moment of it, you know. And if it all ended tomorrow, man, I'd still be so thankful and joyful that I got to experience all that I had over the past, you know, few decades. So.
Well, I think this vibe that you put out of gratitude and joy over what you're doing. I mean, what you've done as a career is literally unprecedented. You're a ukulele player. You don't sing. You're an instrumental, and like, it's like amazing what you've done. And I think part of that is not just your incredible talent, but people feel that, man. You know, people vibe on that, and that, especially nowadays, holy crap, man, there's a dire need for that, as you know, so everything you've done is just, it just being yourself basically is just allowed you to have, you know, have all these opportunities, I think.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. Thanks for saying that. Yeah, I was, you know, there have been a lot of musicians, you know, that have helped me and supported me. And I mean, like Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, you know, they really kind of took me under their wing early on and took me out on the road with them. And
that's a so great inspiring. Match, actually. Audience, I mean, marketplace-wise, that's a pretty good match.
Yeah, they were, I mean,
wow.
You know, Bela and Victor, you know, and I mean, all those guys, Future Man, Jeff Coffin was out with them at the time too. He's with the Dave Matthews Band now, but
yes,
man, it was just so incredible. I mean, just being in their presence and being able to play with them, rehearse with them, you know, have them share their insights with me. I was just, amazing. And then, you know, then like a year or two after that, Jimmy Buffett, you know, I was very fortunate to have met Jimmy Buffett. He took me out on the road with him, and I got to tour with him and the Coral Reefer Band, you know, for a couple of years. And that was amazing. You know, till this day, he's still been just so supportive, you know, of the things I do, and it's helped me immensely, you know, just connecting me with people and all of that. I mean, he was, prior to us starting this interview, you know, you mentioned Sonny Landreth, and I met him through Jimmy, you know, Jimmy Buffett, because Sonny used to come out and play with the Coral Reefers, and that's how I met Sonny Landreth. And I mean, I always knew of him, but man, to like hear him in person, like up close and personal, I was just, every night he'd play, man, I'd get like,
yeah, he's pretty awesome,
you know, chills. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's just so moving.
And Jimmy, from a business standpoint, is so smart. I mean, what he's built in music is like, you know, people who don't know about
him. He's a genius.
Yeah, he definitely is. Definitely is.
But the thing is, it's so genuine. I mean, he really loves what he does. You know, you talk about that joy. And I mean, he is just as joyful on stage as he is off stage. You know,
that's cool.
When we used to finish a show, we'd get off stage, like he'd be jumping around backstage, you know, just be like, oh, high-fiving people, just like, no, yeah, that was a great show, you know. She just loves it. And you know, so being able to see that and have, you know, be a fly on the wall and kind of see that, man, that was so inspiring as well.
Yeah, that is awesome. You once said, this is kind of funny, you said, one of the best things about playing ukulele is that the audience has such low expectations.
Yeah.
And I thought that was funny. How did you recognize that, and how has that, I guess, helped you?
Well, you know, I think when I first started out performing as a soloist, I loved keeping that idea in the back of my head, because it helped to ease the pressure,
yeah,
of performing, you know.
You know what, that's very important, actually. That's a great cue to keep in your mind. Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
because familiarity, I'm assuming, because how many times have you seen an ukulele player in concert?
Yeah, and I realized, you know, in the beginning I did a lot of covers, because I didn't have any confidence in my songwriting. You know, I still have very little confidence in my songwriting. but I did a lot of covers, because I realized that for a lot of people who weren't familiar with the ukulele, if they heard a song that they were familiar with, it helped to kind of close that gap a little bit, you know, kind of bridge the
yeah, accept the instrument. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
So I really enjoyed doing that. And then it got to the point where I love playing songs that people wouldn't expect to hear on the ukulele.
Like, right? The Ozzy.
Yeah, yeah.
did they call you on that? Did anybody from Ozzy's camp call you or anything? That was pretty funny.
No. And you know, and I think, and I believe that, so the reason I remember covering that, I mean, that was back in 2004, I think, or three, when that album came out, and it was first released in Japan. And I remember it was my A&R at Sony, you know, who said, he said, hey, you should cover this song. And it was for that reason, he said, because no one would expect to hear this song, you know, on the ukulele. But it's actually a really beautiful song.
It is.
You know, it's not your typical, you know, Ozzy Osbourne song. It really is a beautiful ballad. Mm. And just a great melody, you know, so it lends itself great. You know, it lends itself perfectly, you know, to the ukulele.
Very cool, man. In 2012, you released an album called Grand Ukulele that was produced by Alan Parsons, the great Alan Parsons. How did that come about, and what was that experience like?
Yeah, that was surreal.
Yeah.
You know, he had I was playing in Santa Barbara, and he came out to the show, and I'll just And yeah, and I remember I couldn't believe it. I was like, wait, what? Like the Alan Parsons is like, like Abbey Road, Alan Parsons is coming to the show.
Dark Side of the Moon, Alan Parsons. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just remember my sound engineer, you know, at that time who I was working with, he was just freaking out because he was like, oh my gosh, I don't want to mix the show if Alan Parsons is going to be here. But
yeah, that's
but
pressure.
Yeah, I remember he came out to soundcheck too. And then, you know, he kind of hung out during soundcheck. And then after the show, I got to talk with him and he's like, hey, are you hungry? So I was like, yeah, sure. So we went out, he took me to this little sushi place and, you know, we had dinner together and I just was sitting there the whole time. I mean, I remember I barely touched my food because I was like, I can't believe I'm sitting here with Alan Parsons. And he's the nicest guy too. You know, he's just, you know, he's a tall, you know, tall, big guy. So he's pretty intimidating when you see him. But just such a sweet person. And so we had dinner and then he just mentioned, he said, hey, you know, if you ever want to, if you ever want to work together, you know, I would love to produce one of your records.
Twist my arm. Yeah.
I was like, are you kidding me? So I was like, wait, are you serious? Are you being serious? You know, he's like, yeah, of course. So I was like, all right. And then I called him. I said, okay, let's do it. You know, and then a couple months later we were in the studio, you know, recording that record.
That's amazing.
He brought some killer people, you know, to the table. Like Kip Winger did a lot of the orchestration. You know, he's such a talented orchestrator.
I've heard that.
And it was just Simon Phillips. He brought in Simon Phillips to play drums on a couple of the tracks. I was like,
yeah, I had him on the show here. He's amazing. Yeah, he's a really bright guy on top of just being a great drummer.
Yeah, it was but anyways, you know, so working with him in the studio was just unbelievable. And his ears, Alan's ears are just, the way he hears things, it's just incredible. I mean, he was like, I remember one time I was kind of playing something in the studio and then he got a phone call, so he ran out. And I could kind of hear him talking, you know, on the phone outside. And I just started kind of playing, you know, I was kind of just kind of practicing and playing a little something. And then he got off the phone and he came running back in and he said, like, hey, what was that thing you played right after that D minor chord thing, right? And I was like, wait, what? So I was like, he's like, yeah, you played the D minor, you know, after the D minor chord, you played this one little transition, you know. So I was like, oh, this? And he goes, yes, that, you know, keep that in, you know. I mean, so he's like on the phone, you know, like talking, but he's still like so aware of everything that's going on. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, he's just, I remember working with him, on one of his records, and he invited me to play on a song, an old piece from Fantasia called The Sorcerer's Apprentice. I don't know if you remember
that. I do.
So he had me come and play on that, and we had to do it remotely. So he sent me the track, and I remember playing I was playing one of the mallet parts on the ukulele. I had to transcribe that for the uke. And so I played it. And we were Skyping. And I remember he was like listening. He said, oh, you know, can you redo this one section? You know, that third or fourth note in there, it kind of didn't really ring out clearly. He's listening on Skype.
On Skype. You know? Wow.
And so I'd go back and listen and be like, yeah, you're right. It is. It kind of like didn't really, it's just like, it was like a fuzziness to the tone.
Wow.
But yeah. He's just so brilliant. So
what was your biggest takeaway from working with him? Like
from maybe, working with him?
Yeah. The thing you learned the most or.
I think my biggest takeaway from that experience was just I think I realized I think, you know, because Alan is very old school, right? So, you know, with the digital side of recording, like some of the Pro Tools and, you know, using those things, you know, it's you know, at the time, you know, he wasn't quite as familiar, right, with like working the keyboard and all that. So he had an engineer that kind of did that part for him. But as far as just the sound, like capturing the sound, capturing the vibe, capturing the essence, you know, of the execution of the performance, right? I mean, to me, like you can't learn that. Like anybody, you know, you can learn the shortcuts on the keys, right, and all that, right? Anybody can do that. But what he brings to the table, you know, with his ears, like that kind of stuff, you can't, that is just pure genius, you know? And so I realized that, you know, I think it's not so much about the gear or the plugins or the, you know, all this stuff, right, that you have on your laptop nowadays or your computer. But man, there's just something about like when he sets up the way he recorded that orchestra, you know, it was just unbelievable. I mean, you listen to, there's a track on there called Missing Three that he when he mic'd up that orchestra, man, it was just like, I remember watching him mix that song, and he just was there in front of the faders, and he just kind of like started pushing up the faders and doing this, and then it was like I used to tell people, it was like, you know how they used to have those 3D images, like you would stare at it and then all of a sudden the picture would reveal itself.
Uh-huh.
That was the exact experience I had. It was like he would like kind of play with the faders and be like, you know, all right, here's the ukulele and here's the, you know, here's the oboe, here's the, you know, strings. And he would just like push things up. And all of a sudden it was like the sound just kind of was like, okay, there it is. And then all of a sudden it just kind of like, shoo.
Wow.
And that was like the mix, you know?
It's almost like seeing a modern day, like a Beethoven or somebody work, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, it was just, he just the way he hears things. And that's the other thing I realized too is, you know, it's like someone like Alan Parsons, when he hears something, it's like, you know, like if I'm listening to a mix, right, I'm trying to listen to everything and try to figure out like, okay, you know, is the bass in the right place? Is the hi-hat in the, you know, like you're trying to make something happen, right? But like with Alan, it's just like, he just sits there, he listens, and it's just like, he just knows what to do intuitively. You know, it's just another level.
That's cool. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, it's so watching him work was just mind-blowing.
What Jake, what would you say the top three musical experiences you've had, and what made them so much fun and so memorable?
Oh gosh, well, one thing that kind of sticks out for me was you know, a few years ago, well, more than a few years ago now, 10 years ago actually, I was with Bette Midler. We were up in London, and we performed for the royal family up there, and we both got to meet, you know, Queen Elizabeth. That was amazing.
I heard the story you told. That was so. Could you? I'm sorry to ask you to do this. Could you tell the story again? Like, what? That was so funny. Like, they warned you. And then you came out and you couldn't help yourself. If you could tell that story, well, that was great.
Man. Yeah. So the long story of it is, it was for the it's called the Royal Variety Performance, which is like a charity concert, you know, put on by the royal family every year. And so, you know, I was up there with Bette to perform with her, and we did one of my favorite Beatles songs. It was In My Life. But and there were other artists there, like Michael Bublé was there, Lady Gaga was there, Miley Cyrus. I mean, so it was like, you know, it was a huge event. And after the performance, I remember being so nervous, but, you know, we played. But after the show, we were all invited backstage at the Opera House to meet Queen Elizabeth, right? So I was so excited. I couldn't believe I was going to have this opportunity. So we were all lined up backstage, and I remember the producer of the show came back, and he wanted to go over with us some of the rules. So, you know, in a nutshell, he told us, just remember three things. He said, the first thing is you're not allowed to reach for her hand. You have to wait until she extends her hand to you. The second thing is you're not allowed to speak to her first. You have to wait until she speaks, and then you can speak. And the third thing that he said was, you know, you don't have to worry about bowing. You know, you don't have to bow in this context because it's just a very casual meeting. So you don't have to do that. So I thought, okay, good. One less thing for me to worry about.
Right.
And, you know, so.
This is great.
So you got to imagine this, right? There's about 15 of us just lined up backstage, and we're waiting, you know, for Her Majesty to arrive. So we're all lined up straight like this, just waiting. You know, I was so nervous. But I tell people that I think it's the Japanese in me, because as soon as she entered the room, like, I kid you not, I was the only one like standing like this. As soon as she entered the room, I was bowing so quickly.
Oh my God.
Like a chicken.
Nervous, man. I can't imagine how nervous you must have been.
It was just like this, you know, this instinctive like thing. It's just like just in my blood, you know.
That's great, man.
But she was so gracious. She came around, and you know, we all got to shake her hand, and and we got to talk with her, and she was just so down to earth, so generous with her time, and so I mean, that was definitely one of the great memories, you know.
Let's check it out.
Yeah, recently. Yeah, I just had this because someone just interviewed me. You know, I mean, it's been so sad with her passing recently, yeah. Right? But yeah, so this was the photo of me.
Wow, that's so cool.
And, yeah,
I mean, it's amazing what your ukulele, like where your ukulele has taken you, man.
Oh yeah,
it's mind blowing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, I just kind of every once in a while I stop and I get to kind of reflect, you know, on all the doors, you know, that this little instrument has opened for me, and just so blown away, you know. So
yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
So, what would be number two? Musical experience.
Number two, I would have to say. Maybe about right around that time, maybe about maybe the year after, I got to perform my first experience recording of a full concerto with the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra.
Oh, that must have been great.
That was pretty, pretty cool. It was a piece written by Dr. Byron Yasui, who's a composer from Hawaii, classical composer from Hawaii. And he wrote this 30-minute piece. And it was the most challenging and most exhilarating piece of music I'd ever played. You know, it was completely atonal. very, you know, written in a, in the, in like contemporary classical form, you know, so it was music that I was very unfamiliar with. So it was definitely out of my wheelhouse.
When you say atonal, what do you mean by that?
So atonal, very dissonant, you know, it's not the kind of music like you would walk away humming the melody, you know, I mean, it's more conceptual, right?
Okay.
So it was, and the whole premise of the piece was, it was, he called it like the anti-ukulele song because what he did was, in traditional ukulele tuning, right, you have your highest string is an A, which is the one closest to the ground, mm-hmm. and you have an E below that and then a C below that, but then your fourth string jumps up a fifth to a high G.
Okay.
So you have your two high strings on the outside, which are only a major second apart.
Right.
And then you have the E and the C, which are your two lower strings in the middle. So within those four strings, you have every interval represented, right? Like you have your minor third because you have the E and the G.
Right.
You have your major third because of the C and the E.
Mm-hmm.
You have your fourth because of the E and the A.
Right.
You have your fifth. You have your so you have every interval except for the minor second and the tritone.
That's pretty amazing.
Those are the only two intervals that's not present on the open tuning of the ukulele, right? So he wrote a piece based on the minor second and the tritone, which are the two most dissonant intervals in Western music. So it was a very intense piece, but it was also, he wrote it for me to play in what they call the campanella style, which means that every note has to be played on a different string. So even if you had two neighboring tones, you had to play them on different strings, right? So then it puts another layer of
complexity. Yeah. Right? So you can't go A to B. You've got to go to another string. That's pretty challenging.
The nice thing about that is you get this effect where every note can ring over the other note, right?
Yeah, right.
So it's like, I don't know if you can hear this, but this looks like a... So if this is... I don't have a ukulele, that's too... These are all my baritone. These are all my...
Those are baritone ukuleles?
Yeah. So for example, if I were playing something like this, right, all on, but if I were to play them each on different strings.
So oh, yeah.
Each other, yeah.
You know what, man? You got pretty big hands. I've just realized that. Yeah, you've got big hands there. You're.
Well, it's only because the instrument is small. So.
No, you have big, thick fingers there, man. So since you learned this style, have you written a bunch of songs like that?
After that experience, I noticed that my threshold for dissonance, you know, it really expanded my threshold for dissonance. So
interesting.
I notice in my playing a lot more, you know, I do gravitate toward those more clustered voicings, you know, where I can incorporate that minor second, you know, in there with the, especially with the first and the fourth string being only a major second apart, right?
Right.
You know, it's so easy to get those, that tension. So it definitely influenced my playing a lot.
And
I think in a good way, in a really good way, you know? So yeah, if you listen to, especially like, in that track with you mentioned earlier about Warren Haynes. You know, there's a lot of you know, and I think in a lot of the trading that we do, you know, there's a lot more tension, you know,
on the road to freedom.
On the road to freedom. Yeah, okay. For sure. So and normally, I mean, that's something that developed more in the last, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years of my playing, rather than I definitely wasn't incorporating those types of, you know, that type of dissonance, I think, in my playing like 10 years ago.
That's cool, man. You could identify things where you're growing as a player. It's hard to do when you're at the level you're at. You know, you're not, if you can get little things like, you know, progress, that's great.
Yeah. And it's different too. I mean, of course you can always apply, right, these kinds of concepts, but to actually like feel it and hear it there, so you can do it spontaneously, or you can, like, as you're playing, that's, you know, that's where you want to go.
Right.
Like, it's not, you know, cause like, I think before, and I think we're all like that. And I still do this today where, you know, you learn a new concept and like, oh, I want to apply that, you know, to this. So you start putting it in everything that you do.
Sure.
Right. But then there comes a point that, like, the more you do it and it becomes a part of you, then it's like, you don't think so much about putting it in there. It just, you know, I don't know, it just kind of flows out of you
without
you having to think about it. So, I love when I learn a new concept and then I find that I start just using it spontaneously without having to force it, or, you know what I mean? So, yeah. So even, I mean, and I think that's just part of growing, right, as a musician.
Totally.
You just start to, you know, like, it's like when you learn a new vocabulary word.
Yeah.
And then you try to use it all the time, right? To like, oh, I'm going to try to throw it in here or throw it in there, right? But then afterwards, it just becomes part of your everyday speech, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of it.
That is cool. Where did you grow up when you were a kid? Where in Hawaii did you grow up? And what was your childhood like?
In Honolulu, on Oahu, and spent most of my time on the, you know, just love the beach. I love fishing and diving, snorkeling, all that stuff. So I didn't do a lot of surfing, but there was a period in my life where I did surf and things like that. But then one day I realized how dangerous it was. Like, I almost died. So I after that I sold my board and I never looked back.
Dude, I'll stick with fishing any day. I love fishing. you must have amazing fishing out there.
You know, it's not as good as it used to be.
Why?
And I
overfishing?
Yeah, you know, so it's harder to find some of those it's harder to find, you know, there's less and less secret spots now.
Yeah, right, the honey holes we call them.
Yeah. So, but you know, you get lucky every now and then. Yeah. And then another big problem now too is the bleaching of the coral, right? So we have a lot of coral bleaching in Hawaii. I mean, I think it's everywhere, but so because of that, the fish don't come in as much, you know, so you kind of have to go further out now with a boat, or a lot of people do kayak fishing, or
that's too bad.
You're not as successful from the shore anymore, you know.
Why? How does a coral get bleached? What's going on with that?
Yeah, there's a lot of different causes, right? Pollution, runoff into the ocean, but also the temperature of the water.
Oh shit!
Like that. So yeah.
God. Jake, what were some of the low points or dark periods you've had to deal with in life, and how'd you get through them?
Oh man. Well, you know, music has always been the thing that has helped me, you know, through some of the most challenging times in my life. And, you know, whether it was the divorce of my parents, or, you know, losing a loved one, know, when my grandfather passed away, that was a really tough time for me.
Sorry, man.
Yeah, I just, you know, music has kind of been the thing that has gotten me through a lot, you know, because I'm not growing up, I was never the type to like really share my feelings with people. You know, I always kind of kept things inside. And, but so I think music kind of became my outlet.
Hmm.
You know, like there are times where I play and I feel like I can just pour whatever I'm feeling into that. And it helps me to kind of let go and release, you know, some sure. of those things. And, and I know it does that for a lot of people, you know, even if you're not playing an instrument, you know, sometimes just listening to the right song can just help put you at ease.
Oh God. Yeah, absolutely, man. Jake, what are some moves you made or things that you did that as you look back over your career, you can definitely attribute some of your success to those things?
Oh man. Gosh, there's just so many things, you know, I mean, and all the things that I can think of, you know, that I could write down and think of, there's probably like, you know, 10 times there's probably, you know, I mean, 10 times more things that I will never know, you know, because they happen behind the scenes
yeah.
or, you know, that people that just kind of do for you and they never tell you that they helped you with stuff, right? I mean, I used to share this story all the time of how like when I graduated high school, I wanted to get a job and I went to work at this music store, and I used to go down to that music store every weekend, you know, to kind of talk with the manager to kind of get to know him better. And then one day I went in and, you know, asked for a job application. And then went home and filled it out all by myself. And, you know, then took the bus, went back down to the music store, dropped it off. And a couple of days later, they called me to come in for an interview. And I went in, showed up half an hour early, and they hired me on the spot, you know? And I was like, oh man. And I remember being so proud, like, yeah, you know, I got this job all on my own and all that. And then I worked there for 5 years. And I remember on my last day, I told my boss, his name was Dennis. And I said, hey, Dennis, you know, I just wanted to thank you, you know, for giving me a chance, you know, because you hired me on the spot. I had no experience. And, you know, so I'm just so grateful, you know, because this job has, I learned so much from this job and I loved working here. And he told me, said, oh, well, the only reason I hired you is because after you turned in your application, your uncle came down to the store and told me, hey, you better hire my nephew. So that's 5 years, so I lived yeah. a lie thinking that I got this job all on my own, you know, but
that's great.
But it's just, you know, it's just a reminder for me. It's just a constant reminder that, you know, that there are always people helping you, you know,
yeah.
and even though you may think like, no, I worked hard to get where I am. You know, there's so many people who sacrifice and, you know, helped you to get where you are, you know, whether you yeah. know it or not. So that always kind of keeps me humble, you know, just remembering that incident.
Your gratitude is something that you, I feel like based on talking to you, it's something you've always possessed. Where did you get that from? You just seem very appreciative. Like you don't take anything for granted, it seems like, which is really nice. Where did that come from?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I guess my parents and my grandparents, maybe, you know, I think I know growing up, my you know, I'm a fourth generation, you know, Japanese American, right? So when my great grandparents, you know, came over to Hawaii, you know, they came with nothing, right? So they basically worked in the plantation fields, and then my grandmother, you know, grew up, again, very poor, you know, couldn't even really go to school. And then when she had my mom, you know, she, you know, tried to work really hard so at least my mom could go to school. And you know, and my mom did. And she just, you know, she ended up just kind of dropping out before, you know, graduating high school. And so I remember when I was a kid growing up, my mom always telling me, you know, you better be the first one in this family to graduate high school and get your high school diploma, you know. So I think that way of thinking was always, you know, I realized like every generation before me kind of made sacrifices so that the next generation could try to have a better life, right?
Right.
And so just like how my mom sacrificed for me and my brother so we could have these opportunities, you know, my grandmother sacrificed so much for my mom and her and my great grandmother, you know, and so forth. And so I think there was always this gratefulness, but also this pressure to do well so that, you know, to work hard so that all the sacrifices that were made, you know, before, you know, weren't made for nothing, right?
So yeah.
I always felt that if I could achieve something, like when I graduated high school, I felt like that was a huge thing for my family because like, oh, now finally, you know, someone, someone has, you know, and so hopefully, you know, my children will maybe be the first to get a college degree, you know,
sure.
So we'll see. But it's always, you know, so it's, I think, there's a Japanese word that my grandmother taught me and it was Okage Samade, which means I am what I am because of you, you know, so it, and that is something that always kind of stuck with me, you know, because it's like, you know, all the, whatever, anything that I achieve in my life or, you know, whatever success I have, you know, it's not just my own success, but it's the success of, you know, of all the generations that came before me, right? And you can think about that just in your own, the context of your own family, but also you can think of it in the context of your community or your country or what, I mean, whatever, right? You can apply it to anything and just apply that gratefulness and humility, right? To,
you know,
things.
Thank you. That was a very, thank you for answering that so thoroughly. And so growing up in New York City, I grew up with kids from every culture all over the world. And I have to tell you, ethnic families have much more ties to previous generations than the average white Americans do, for sure. All my friends that I grew up with that were, you know, Asian or wherever they were from somewhere else originally, right? Mm-hmm. All had the same sense of not just respect, but you said you felt like you had a duty to pay it forward. You know, to carry, to recognize that and to sort of like honor those sacrifices. And I was always in awe of that because I thought that was very cool. And I thought it kept families together. I think it's like a better glue, a relationship glue, if you want to call it that, for keeping your families together, you know, past, present, and future. And just that sense of family and community. And I always admired that. So I'm not surprised with your answer. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, man. Musically, is there anything you haven't done yet that you'd like to?
Oh, there's so many things.
Oh, dude, oh, man. Talk about it.
I just, yeah, I mean, I would like, I mean, especially like with composition wise, I mean, you know, it's always been my dream to one day write, a piece for full orchestra, you know, maybe to write my own ukulele concerto one day or something like that. I mean, that would be something I would love to do, or score music, you know, for a full orchestra for a film or something like that.
Now you did score a couple of movies, Japanese movies.
Yeah, I did actually. Yeah, there were two films that I got to do. One was a movie called Hula Girl, which was a Japanese film based on a true story, and then another one was a Japanese remake of a movie called Sideways.
Oh yeah, so
that
yeah.
was fun. Mm. But I did. But yeah, most of the music there, I wrote on the ukulele and performed it on the ukulele. And there was like a couple of there was a quartet part that I wrote for it, but mainly it was all for the ukulele, you know. So I would love to expand on that and be able to do full orchestration one day. I would love to be able to conduct.
Oh, that'd be awesome, man.
An orchestra one day. I'd love to do that. I remember when I was in high school, I went to a clinic, you know, to a drum major clinic, you know, to conduct the marching band. And I loved that experience. You know, it was so great. And then, yeah, playing wise, you know, I'm still searching for that perfect tone, right? Whether it's, you know, the clean tone, the perfect clean tone, and a perfect, like, you know, dirty tone, and kind of getting that sweet overdrive sound on the ukulele.
What do you use for that?
I'm always experimenting.
What do you typically use?
So different things. Like when I'm in the studio, most of the time I'll go through, I'll experiment with different amps. I've gone through, like a Fender Bassman, you know, there was a record I did called Nashville Sessions.
And I love that record.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
thank
it was so, kind of, that was great. It was live with you, and that, I liked it because you did so many cool things on there with all these pedals, and you know, it was very electric. Yeah. It was cool.
So that was there's two songs on there. There's one called Man of Mud, and then another one called Kilauea, and those two I played through the Fender Bassman amp, and just like cranked that over, just cranked that, and it was so cool, man. It just I love the sounds that we got on that album. But when I play live, you know, a lot of times it's tough, right, to always bring an app with you. So it's hard to get the consistency. So I found myself gravitating more toward using amp simulators.
Sure.
And you know, the technology, I mean, has gotten so good. I remember when the Tech 21 stuff came out and the original Line 6. Remember that red pod thing? But you know, and the technology has just evolved so much, and so there's just so many great options out there now. And you know, if you tweak it just right, you can get a pretty decent sound.
You may have heard of GAS, you know, guitar acquisition syndrome. Have you ever heard that? gear acquisition? Okay, which is basically the constant overconsumption of guitars and gears. Do you experience something similar to that with ukuleles and gear? Like, is there this, I'm not really like that, but I mean, I read about it a lot. I'm like more utilitarian. If I buy it and I use it, great. If not, I sell it. But you know, a lot of guys, it's just like, hey, it's Thursday, it's new guitar day. I'm like, what? What are you like with ukuleles and gear?
I'm not like that with instruments, you know, because I'm the type, like, I get one instrument and I just, like, that just becomes the one,
right,
you know, that I use for everything. So
wait a minute. There's four right behind you right there.
Oh yeah. Well, so these are, are ukuleles that I've, acquired over the years. But these, mainly these are all baritones that I mainly use in the studio.
Okay.
I used to tour with a baritone, you know, for like a couple of songs, but my main instrument is the tenor.
Okay.
You know, the tenor four strings. So that one, I don't have it in this room right now. It's downstairs, but that's the one that I tour with, I record with, it's made by a family called the Kamaka family. They were the first family to start manufacturing ukuleles
in Hawaii
over 100 years ago. I mean, they're credited with like inventing the modern day ukulele, you know, basically. So, but yeah, they started, their company started in 1916.
In Hawaii?
In Hawaii. And they were, and, you know, obviously they were making ukuleles even before that, but yeah, but officially, you know, started their company in 1916, in a little shop in Kaimuki, which is where I live now. But
that's so cool.
But yeah, so I and every few years, Casey Kamako, who's like a fourth generation or third generation ukulele luthier, you know, from this Kamaka lineage, he's there. You know, he does all their custom luthier work. But yeah, he's just so incredibly talented. But every few years, like he makes me a new one. You know, he kind of experiments and tries different things.
That's every really years, freaking cool, man.
I get a new one. Yeah, I mean, I'm so lucky because, you know, I thank him all the time, you know, because I tell him it's because of his instruments, you know, I mean, that really inspires me to push myself and to, you know, to play. Like every time he gives me a new instrument, I'm like, okay, that's pressure. And like, I you know, kind of like, what's the next, you know, what's the next step? Cause he just, every time he makes a new instrument, it's just like, it just surpasses the one before, you know, somehow. I don't know what it is, but
that's awesome.
It's amazing. And, you know, to be able to have that relationship with the luthier, right?
Oh God. Yeah.
You know, we've been friends forever. So, and you know, he knows my playing, he knows, you know, I mean, everything about me. So, people sometimes ask me like, what requests, you know, like if I ask him, oh, can you use this wood or do whatever? And I always just tell people, no, I mean, that's, you know, he's the master. So I just tell him, just make whatever you want.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I know nothing about making instruments. So, but it's such a joy to be able to play an instrument that responds, you know, is so sensitive that it responds to every little thing that you do. You know, that's what makes an instrument so great.
Yeah.
You know, it's that when it's sensitive enough to like pick up on all the subtle things that you're doing, right, with your fingers, because then you can, I like to tell people that the, you know, the reason I like just sticking to one instrument when I play is because if I just play that one instrument, you know, I can learn all the subtleties and all the subtle nuances of that instrument that gives it its character, right?
Yeah.
But as I'm doing that, I like to also think that the instrument is also learning me.
Yeah.
Right. So it's learning that, okay, when I do this, or when I pull back on the body like this and play this chord, you know, this is the sound or the tone that I'm trying to get out of it, right? So it's really interesting, you know, just the way you hold it, the, you know, on a certain, like every instrument has its own little characteristics, right? That like maybe on this fret, you need to kind of push in this way to get a little bit more out of that note, or, you know, or when you strum, like maybe strumming over the 12th fret, you know, here, or like a little bit back toward the 15th fret, you know, to get like a certain brightness that you want. I mean, it's like every instrument's, it's so different, right? So you got to learn all these little things so that you can build your emotional vocabulary with that instrument in a way, I guess. Yeah.
And you play with your fingernails, correct?
Yeah,
And they're not super long. They're like,
oh yeah, no, they're very short. But
yeah,
it's but I like using the fleshier part of my fingers,
right.
So I get a little bit more warmth.
Yeah,
you know, on the strings. Yeah,
yeah. This is really. Oh, do you have a worst gig ever story?
Worst gig? Oh. I've had shows where I have some like really embarrassing like moments on stage. There was this I remember I just shared this story the other day. There was a there was this, I played at this small little performing arts center. I can't remember exactly what city it was in, but I remember that, you know, so I'm on stage, right? So behind me, there's a curtain, and even the sides, there's just these curtains. So you can't see the walls. So you enter from stage left, mm-hmm. you enter and exit from stage left, because on the right side, there's just basically behind the curtain is just a brick wall.
Okay.
So I remember during sound check, the stage manager said, "Oh, Jake, just remember, yeah, when you come off stage, make sure you come back the same way you went on, because, you know, this is the only opening, right?" So I was like, "All right, yeah, no problem. And they put tape on the floor so you kind of know where to part the curtain so you can go through the...
Right.
So I was like, yeah, no worries. So I went out there, I did my show, and I was just playing solo that night. And I remember just being so excited. And after the show, I played my last song, the last thing, and everyone was, you know, like clapping. So I was waving. I was like, "Oh, thank you so much." And I tried to exit
stage right.
So I went to the right, and I find the opening in the curtain, and I opened the curtain, and I kind of go through, and there's about probably like 8 inches between the curtain and the stone wall. And I remember and then at that moment, I realized, oh no, there's no opening on this side. So I just kind of like stayed flat against the wall.
And you walked all the way around?
No. And I just figured, well, I'll just wait till everyone exits the building.
Oh my God. That's a while, man.
So I remember just staying like that, right? And it was just so funny. And I just waited patiently. And then 5 minutes later or whatever, I could hear my tour manager walking toward me and just laughing. And he's like, "You know, from the audience, everyone can see your shoes at the bottom of the curtains."
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
So, and he's just cracking up. He's like, "You can come out now, everyone's gone."
That's hilarious, man. That's pretty funny. That's a good one.
So, oh man. But yeah, I'll never forget that. So now I'm always like, but that was a good lesson, you know, because now I'm very aware of, you know, what side to exit.
Wow. The stage. So this is a funny one. You're of all the records in the world that you're talking about, you mention a very popular for its time, but also extremely obscure record called "Hello Mudda, Hello Fada" by Alan Sherman, that's released in 1963. How the hell did you even stumble across that record? That's what I wanted to know, man. And like, what do you like? I was like, I couldn't believe that. I know it because I guess they may have played it in New York. And I mean, I was born in 63, but you know, I was in that era and they may have played it. And then I bought it as an adult. And funny enough, my older son loves it, who's 32. But when he was a little kid, he used to love it. But how did you come across that record, Jake? That was so random, man.
I grew up listening to that album and it was like one of my favorite ones. I mean, Hello Mudda. I mean, till this day, you know, if I get invited out to a karaoke bar or something with friends,
that's what you're saying.
And if I'm forced to sing, that is the song I sing.
That's great.
Hello Mudda, hello Fada, here I am at Camp Granada.
So funny. I couldn't believe that was when you said that. I was like, wow, that is really random.
That was the same album that had that song, right? His car went beep beep beep, right?
I don't remember, but I know what's funny? When I was doing your questions, I thought I had it and I looked for it. I know I have it somewhere in my albums, but I couldn't find it. I wanted to show it to you because I had it when I was a kid and I'm still in there somewhere.
Man. That's a classic.
Yeah.
It's such a classic. Yeah. And I think it was a live album, right?
Yes, it was.
I think, yeah, there was a... You could hear the audience just cracking up in the background. Yeah,
absolutely. Did you know if you read about that guy, he was quite the playboy. He was like
really?
A notorious philanderer. Yeah, man. And he, you know, he was like having like blatant affairs on his wife, and then he got another wife and did the same thing. And he didn't have a very good ending, I don't think, if I remember correctly. But but you look at the guy and you hear what he's singing, you wouldn't like, you know, being a playboy and him, that image doesn't really like connect immediately. You know? I was like, what? So it was funny. I couldn't believe that, man. Tell me your top three Desert Island discs. No particular order, and just for this minute.
Oh, gosh. Well, one of them would definitely have to be an Ultrasound record.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. He had... Oh, there's so many great tunes. The classic one is Song for Anna.
Okay.
You know, that he recorded with Andre Pop. And I mean, I think till this day, that is probably the highest selling ukulele instrumental song, I think, ever.
That's amazing.
You know, I can't verify, but it's gotta be. I mean, that thing.
Song for Anna.
Sold millions and millions of records. I mean, of albums. So would definitely be Ultrasound's Song for Anna. What else would be another good one? Oh, maybe Jeff Buckley, Grace, I think it would be another great one. And shucks. You know what album I just recently started, I just checked out because she released one during the pandemic, was and I really love it, is Fiona Apple's latest record. I think it's like something about bolt cutters or something like that. But man,
I'll have to check that one
wicked,
out.
Wicked record. Yeah. Should definitely check that one out too.
I will. Hey, just a few more questions, and thank you very much for everything, man. It's been awesome talking to you. When you called me last night, I was like, God, this guy is like, you could just like feel that aloha spirit. You know, I've been to Hawaii twice, and people say, oh, you know, the Islanders, I love it there. Everybody's so freaking nice to me. I never knew what these people were talking about. I was like, oh my God, I could hang out there. Like you just, you know, when we go, I don't usually go to the tourist places. I like to, you know, pull into a local cafe that serves fish and rice or something.
Oh yeah, of course,
because that's where you get the good, to me that's where you get the good food. Mm-hmm, you know, and mm-hmm. that's where you get to listen and talk to people, and you know, they're more willing to open up. And so, and you just personified that last night just in that little short conversation. It's like, I you know, when you talk with somebody and you feel better after you talk to them, and all you did was ask me to move the interview, I was like, man, this guy is going to be awesome. Yeah. I mean, but there, you know, it's like when you're playing, man, there's an energy transference, right? And some people leave you feeling more energy, and other people leave you feeling so exhausted. You're like, man, I got to get this person out of my life. You know? But you were definitely the first, not in the second.
Oh, thank you.
Best decision you ever made?
Oh, best decision I ever made. Gosh. Marry my wife.
That's a good one. How long have you been married or together?
11 years now.
Awesome, man. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite venue that you've played in? I know you've played all over the world.
Ooh, that's a tough one.
Probably not curtains.
Well, since I just got back from Japan, there was a, you know, one of the venues we play of there. It's called the EX Theater in Tokyo. I think it's in Roppongi, the EX Theater. Yeah, that's always a nice hall. It's perfect for the ukulele. I think, you know, for that, it's intimate, but you know, it's still got like a a great hall feel and just a wonderful energy. So yeah, we did two nights there to end the tour, and it was just a great show.
That's awesome. You play here. I'm in Tampa. You play here a lot at Ruth Eckerd.
Oh gosh, that's another beautiful hall.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great place to see the show. And last question, Jake, what's the biggest change in your personality, would you say, over the last 10 years? Do you need to grab that or something?
No, I'm good.
What's the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that change has been intentional, and how much is just a natural part of aging?
Wow. Well, I think definitely having children changed me a lot, you know, because I think I've definitely a lot more patient, you know, and definitely more patient. And I think the having children and thinking about the, you know, when they were really young, and just thinking about the kind of relationship I want to have with them. Mm. As they get older, yeah, this weird thing happened where I started looking the other way and looking at my parents and realizing, like, wow, however I want the way that I want my children to have the kind of relationship with me, right, as they get older, that's the kind of relationship I need to make sure that I'm reflecting with my parents. Right. So, right. You know, so both my parents are, you know, my parents divorced when I was really young. And I mean, and my mom and dad, they're still friends. I mean, they don't hate each other or anything like that, but you know,
that's actually a big plus.
Yeah. Yeah. It was huge. I mean, that was huge in our, you know, when I was growing up, for sure. But yeah, so I found myself like, realizing that, you know, I need to, because my parents are really the type, like, they're happy if they know I'm happy, or they want me to, you know, to go out and do what I love doing. And,
right.
You know, and because I travel, you know, a lot, so I'm away from home, but I did, I know I realized in the last few years, like, you know, like really making a much stronger effort to spend time, you know, with them. Like, with my mom and with my dad, and you know, because I realized, like, oh my gosh, that's gonna be me and my kids one day. Yeah. Right. And it's just, wow, it just kind of blew me away. I mean, it, you know, because I think up until a few years ago, like, I still felt like I was in my 20s, you know, but I'm really not.
But it's a good thing though, man. You know, honestly, it you know, yeah, not feeling you're taking care of yourself, whatever you're doing is working for you, you know, whether it's, yeah, you know, just the emotional impact of performing and playing, or, you know, physically taking care of yourself. I don't know what you do, but, you know, that's great that you feel like you're in your 20s.
Yeah. I mean, time just flies, man.
Yeah.
Time waits for no one.
No.
It's just, yep. So, yeah, that was a kind of an eye-opening experience, you know, when I kind of saw myself as my kids and my parents as me, you know,
right.
Because, you know, you always, I don't know, like, I've always just seen my parents as my parents, and you never see yourself as, or maybe it was just me, but I just never thought of myself as, oh, one day I'm going to be, that's going to be me, you know. It's like, yeah, the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
well, who wants to think about, it's tough to, I mean, I know for myself, I don't want to think about getting old.
Yeah.
That much older, you know, 5, 10 years. Mm-hmm. Sure. But like, you know, not like 30 years older, you know, so who the hell wants to think about that? God, I'm like you. I want to be in my 20s and I feel like that.
I know.
Hey, listen, first of all, I want to thank you very much for everything. It's a real privilege to talk to you. I'm so happy for everything that you've done with your career. You couldn't happen to a nicer, more well-deserving guy, and keep putting the good vibes out there like you're doing. And I will see you next time you come to Ruth Eckerd. Let me tell people your last record. It's called Jake and Friends. It's a great record. It's got Jake and tons of guest stars on there. Sonny Landreth, Jack Johnson, Ziggy Marley, Kenny Loggins. I mean, this is a who's who. Warren Haynes, Lucas Nelson, Billy Strings, Vince Gill, and Amy Grant. How did you get all these people together, man? This is like Willie Nelson, you know, Michael McDonald. Who is the secret sauce behind that?
Yeah, no, I know. I was very fortunate. You know, Ray Benson, who's also on the record, he helped me co-produce this record. And when we first started talking about it, you know, he said, man, I got to get you together with Willie Nelson. And he made a phone call, and a few months later, there we were in the studio, and we recorded Stardust. And, you know, and after that, once we had Willie Nelson.
Yeah, on everybody's project, like signing.
Everybody
up, right?
Was like, "Oh, I'm in." Yeah, yeah. I'm in. You know?
That's cool, man. That's good. It's a great record, and I would love everybody to check it out. All of Jake's, man, Jake's catalog is awesome. It's great to sit down, relax. He does a lot of cool stuff on there. On the last record, I like the track On the Road to Freedom. We talked about that with Warren Haynes. I like the track with Billy Strings, Kenny Loggins, Sonny Landreth, the track with Jack Johnson. It's a great record. Also, Jake's got a documentary. It's called Life on Four Strings, and I believe it is on right now anyway. I think it's on Amazon, or is it always on Amazon? Is it one of the staples
there? Yeah. I think recently it's been on Amazon. And
was that weird seeing yourself, a documentary about yourself?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I can't remember what year it came out in. I think it was actually it came out 10 years ago.
Okay.
Because my oldest son is 10 now, and it came out right before he was born.
Okay.
You know, and in fact, I remember my wife was pregnant with him, you know, when we were shooting that documentary. But it's just a great, you know, I love the way that it just captured my family and my former manager, you know, back then, and everything that it really captured that time, you know, because we shot for a couple years, and all these things were just happening as we were shooting this documentary. So, so all of those things, you know, kind of became part of it. And so it just felt very genuine and real, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, best of luck with everything, man. Continue on your awesome adventure. Hold on a second. I'm going to wrap. You. Any final words of wisdom?
No, I just, yeah, well, no, I just want to thank you, you know, for this time. And, you know, there's a word, there's a Japanese word, and it means once in a lifetime, or like, that's the direct translation, but it's really, about just kind of, being grateful, you know, for every moment. 'Cause you know, you're never going to get this moment back.
Oh, hell yeah.
And, you know, so, and the word is Ichigo Ichie. And I think, you know, it has really become like a really important word in my life, especially, you know, after the last few years now.
Oh, yeah.
So I just wanted to say thank you, man, for this opportunity. I had so much fun talking with you, and hope we get to do this again, maybe in person next time.
Next time you come to Ruth Eckerd, that'd be awesome.
Virtual is great, but yeah, there's nothing like that real human connection, right, in person, so.
Likewise, man. Well, hang on one second, and thank you for everything. Everybody, thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Craig.
It was honestly my Aloha. Pleasure. I'm so glad to connect with you. Like I said, it's so gratifying for me when I've been following somebody and I've listened to somebody over so many years, and then to connect with them on the show. It's a beautiful thing for me, so thanks. Thank you, everybody, for listening. If you enjoyed this, share it on your socials. We appreciate your support. Thanks very much to Jake Shimukaburo for everything. Great catalog of music and all his love and positivity. And And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I am out. Thanks for everything, Jake.
Aloha.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.